As you read chapters 16 and 17, you will notice straight away that there are many similarities between these two chapters. And you might be tempted to think that chapter 17 is really a continuation of chapter 16. But I don't believe that the two chapters should be regarded in that way. Because if you read it carefully, verse 22 concludes chapter 16. And there is no direct link. There is a link in theme or in thought, but there is no, grammatically, there is no link to chapter 17. So verse 22 concludes chapter 16. And then the first verse of chapter 17 begins a related but nevertheless different theme. So we need to bear in mind that the two chapters are in content very similar, but they should, properly speaking, be regarded as distinct. They are similar because in chapter 17, Job continues his lament, his complaint over what he is suffering, the fact that it is to him so unmerited, and that it has continued unceasingly for so long. And no one, least of all God, is willing or interested in giving him an explanation why he is undergoing what he is undergoing at this point in time. So it is not surprising that chapter 17 begins in a very depressing way with Job complaining, "My breath is corrupt, my days are extinct, the grave, plural, are ready for me." The word breath is, of course, a familiar word. It's the English equivalent of the Hebrew ruah, which, while it has a variety of meanings in the present context, it refers to the spirit or the life force of a human being. It is that which makes a human being alive. Bear in mind that some scientists have recently claimed to have manufactured a living molecule, and as a criterion of the fact that it is alive, they point to its ability to replicate itself. But in the same breath, they admit there is something missing. Just the process of producing copies of itself, while it may be one of the features of a living organism, is not all there is that makes it alive. So at least as far as man is concerned, there is quite definitely something different about man. And that we know is the soul, or if you prefer to call it the spirit, which God breathes into Adam and which God breathes into every fetus when it is conceived. So that is breath. He's referring to what makes him alive. Is corrupt. How are we to understand this word corrupt? It is not our usual English, present day English understanding of corrupt as something which is spoiled or which is in some way contaminated. Again, we have to go back to the nuances of meaning in the Hebrew word, which is kabal. And we start with the literal meaning. The literal meaning of kabal is to bind as with a rope, or to bind as with a pledge, to hold something down. But that is obviously not the intended meaning here. So what is the intended meaning? And there the context has to guide us. Here this idea of binding with a rope or holding down is really a figurative usage, and it is pointing to really either destruction, outright destruction, or to something that is similar to destruction, which is the wearing down or depletion of something to the point where it's barely able to sustain itself. For example, if you are not in the habit of exercising and you have exerted yourself for a prolonged period of time, at the end of that period, not only are you short of breath, you are panting, your muscles are on the point of giving up, you are just depleted, drained of strength, you just want to flop down into a chair and stare into space. So that is the idea behind the use of Kabbal in this context. What Job is saying is that his afflictions have so drained or depleted his emotional and spiritual strength that he is on the point of collapse. What could it mean to say that my days are extinct? This word in the Hebrew, za'ak, is an interesting word because it is the only such usage in the entire Old Testament. The difficulty with such words is that it can be quite difficult sometimes to appreciate the meaning because there is no comparable usage anywhere else in the Old Testament. Very often the Bible explains itself when we turn to different books of the Bible or different chapters of the same book and see the same word being used maybe in a slightly different context, and that helps us to gauge what the intended meaning is in a given context. But with a word like za'ak, where there's only one recorded instance, and you can prove this by going through a concordance, the difficulty is you are bound by the immediate context, which is Job chapter 17, to glean an idea of what it could mean. My days are extinct. Authorized version correctly renders it that way because za'ak literally means be extinct, to extinguish. So in what sense are his days going to be extinguished? It is to be understood in this sense. The span of life allotted to me is about ready to run out. So it is extinguished in this sense. I have very little time left now. It's about ready to be completely used up and it's not going to come back again. The word graves is in the plural, and before we go into what that could mean, we have to note an interesting feature of this word. If you are able to look at the Hebrew, at least at the transliterated form of the word in the Hebrew, you will find that it is kebarim. And what is interesting is the way the word ends. In the transliterated form, it ends with the letters IM. And does that not recall a very familiar word to us, which also occurs in the plural? If you read Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, in the beginning God created. The word, Hebrew word for God there is Elohim. And the same ending in the transliterated form is the I am ending, signifying that yes, it is a plural form. The root word of course is Keber, from which the plural Kebarim is derived. So why is Job talking about graves in the plural when he should be talking about grave in the singular? And bear in mind that there were at least three types of graves. There was the grave for the people who were wealthy or who were linked to the nobility. And these graves were more properly called bayit, which means in English house. In other words, it would be really a sepulcher. It's a kind of tomb that Joseph of Arimathea built for himself, into which he put the body of Christ. It's an above ground structure, it is elaborate, and it would be in English called a sepulchre. That should have been the resting place of Job, given the social standing that he enjoyed. But he is not referring to Bayit. He is using a very common word, Kebarim, which really refers to a common grave. And not only a common grave, but more in the sense of a mass grave. This is the kind of grave in which, at least in olden times, and probably even down to the 19th century, paupers were laid to rest. Paupers meaning no next of kin came forward to claim the body, no one knows what to do with it. So either the body is given quietly for medical research, or it is dumped into a common grave. Why common grave? Because to give it a proper burial in its own individual slot, even in England in the 19th century, cost a fair bit of money. So the solution was to have a mass grave into which the corpses of these impoverished people could be dumped unceremoniously. So in the usage of Kebarim, bear in mind Job has humbled himself so far as to consider that he is worth nothing more than not only a pauper's grave, but really a mass grave, which means to say after he is dumped, his body is dumped in there, no one will know where he's laid to rest. There is no marker and there is no opportunity for anyone to remember him. He has so reduced himself in his own estimation to that level as to use this word. It is therefore, actually, when we look into this, it should make us realize that what we get out of Scripture depends so much on what we are prepared to put into the reading of it. It is possible to read these verses in this chapter in a very casual way and miss the whole beauty of the chapter, bearing in mind that it is written as a poetic form, which makes it doubly difficult to understand. So consider how Job has, in his own estimation, become reduced to nothing better than a pauper. Does this not tell us, in verse 1, the kind of despair that Job is experiencing? Is really practically rock bottom. You can't imagine anyone sinking below this level, and he is at that point, which is why he has correctly said he has been drained of all his inner resources. Affliction upon his affliction has so drained him that his spirit is exhausted, and he is just getting ready for his life to be extinguished, to be put out. So much for chapter 1. Chapter 2 must be considered, verse 2 must be considered in two parts. Are there not mockers with me? And doth not mine eye continue in their provocation? Again, to appreciate the meaning of this verse, we have no choice but to go back to the Hebrew text, at least in the transliterated form. What does he mean in the first half of this verse? Are there not mockers with me? This much is clear. It is a reference to his three friends, his former friends. And bear in mind that they did not set out to examine his case as judges and then end up criticizing and mocking him. They set out with the best of intentions as his closest friends to find out what had happened to encourage him. But what we must not forget, and I cannot emphasize this often enough, and what the book of Job does not directly say after chapter 2, but we must be aware of, is the unseen hand of Satan working to manipulate the minds and the emotions of people to the extent that he has been, shall we say, permitted by God. And in the case of Job, the bounds of the testing were clearly defined and therefore permitted by God. Satan could not have done this on his own initiative. So bear in mind what Job does not realize yet. And perhaps at the end of the book, he probably never ever realized the hand of Satan behind all this. Because as you come to the last chapter, you will find that even then, God does not reveal to Job what is given to us in chapters 1 and 2. So the poor man had to pass through this stage and get out of it without ever knowing what really was the cause of it all. The only thing he could cling on to was a happy ending. But as to why and wherefore, he remained in the dark. And that is our benefit. Therefore, remember that this mocking and scorning of Job by the three friends was unplanned, unintended, but nevertheless was manipulated and brought about by Satan. And he, Job, is referring to this in the first half of the verse when he says, "Are there not mockers with me?" It's a very pointed way of saying, here they are, here are my former friends, and now they are the chief of those who scorn and mock me. By putting it, phrasing it in the form of a question, the point is driven home more forcefully. That is again a poetic structure which can be used selectively in a very effective way. What exactly does their mockery consist? If you have read thus far, you realize they don't outwardly, or rather openly, brand or attach names to Job by calling him this, that, or the other. But the fact that they are mocking him comes through in their tone, in their choice of words, in the content of what they say. So we must ask at this stage, since Job refers to their mockery, what exactly is this mockery all about? The mockery consists in this. Job can see, and they should be able to see, that Job is getting pretty close to the grave. He's not very far away from the grave because, don't forget, with the ravages of the disease on his body, his appetite is gone, he's not eaten properly, he's basically become like the starving children of whom we have seen pictures, starving children in Somalia, reduced literally to skin and bones with wide staring eyes. Think of Job, though adult, reduced to that stage. Mind still functioning, spirit still strong, but bodily reduced to that level. Therefore, should have been obvious, and I believe it was patent to the three friends, that Job is not going to be around much longer. If that is the case, why on earth, and this is where the mockery consists, why on earth do they keep insisting that Job repent in order to enjoy long life? If you were in Job's shoes, would you not feel incensed when your friends tell you that here is the secret to enjoying a long and happy life, when you know and they should know that you are so reduced to skin and bones, you are only a step away from the grave? that surely is not the time and place to tell somebody about living a long and happy life. So it is that which Job is referring to when he speaks of the friends and their mockery. That much is clear. How are we to understand the second half of the verse? Doth not mine eye continue in their provocation? Here, please be reminded that the King James translators had certain very definite rules of translation, one of which was as far as possible, a literal or word-for-word equivalent. That would necessarily result, and they fully realized it, that the actual meaning may not sometimes be very evident to an English-speaking reader. It would be a very close, practically a literal equivalent as far as the grammatical structure of the language would allow, yet it would make for smooth reading, which is required in churches and in public readings of the word. But the penalty is the meaning might not always come through straight away, as it is so in the second half of this verse. Doth not mine eye continue in their provocation? Were they wrong? No, because here is one of the other rules of their translation is this: the interpretation or explanation is not the job of the translator, it is the job of the preacher or the teacher. Their job is to give as faithful, as accurate a word-for-word rendition in the English language in their case, or whichever language the translator is translating into. That his objective is to give that equivalent, and the job of interpretation is left to others. So with that in mind, what it means is we again have no choice but to go back to the Hebrew text. The word continue in the Hebrew is lun, and it literally means to stop overnight, to spend the night as you would in a motel to break your journey. So that is obviously not the intended meaning here. The figurative meaning has to be drawn out. When you stop overnight, you are resting in some place. It is not an indefinite period of time, but it is a sustained period of time nonetheless. You are resting for a sustained period of time. So what he is saying is his eye rests upon something for an extended period of time. What is it resting upon? And what it is resting upon is the provocation, which in the Hebrew is mara, a word that should be very familiar to many of us. So what does he mean if we put all this together? What Job is saying is this: I look around me, and what do I see? My eye rests upon a very cheerless spectacle, and that's really all that I see. Wherever I look, there are these three clowns in front of me, and all they are doing is one after the other mouthing criticisms. It's worse than a nagging wife, because there are three of them, and it is a surround sound effect going on through the waking hours. And Job is saying, can anything be more depressing than to see this spectacle? And this is all my eye has to rest upon. Every word, every look that they say or look at me with serve only to intensify my emotional and mental anguish. That is the meaning of this entire verse. Are there not mockers with me? Doth not mine eye continue? Really, all I have is, wherever I look in whichever direction, this cheerless spectacle. This is important. It doesn't end there, because it is going to propel him, if he cannot find comfort and solace in the horizontal direction, what does that mean? He has to look in the vertical direction. And that is the link to the next verse, verse 3. He is therefore going to turn his eyes upward to the Lord to find, hopefully, comfort and solace. Verse 3, lay down now, put me in a surety with thee. Who is he that will strike hands with me? What may or may not be evident is there are certain technical words or phrases that occur in this verse. And the general impression is that this verse is best understood in a legal context. And indeed, many of the terms used derive from ancient legal practices. So we must bear that in mind. We cannot append the common everyday meaning to some of these words. These legal practices are not common to us. They relate to the ancient Near East. And unfortunately, there is limited knowledge available even today about the legal practices prevalent in the ancient Near East. So it may not be totally clear what some of these words mean, but we shall try. First and foremost, as we were saying earlier, verse 3 is linked to verse 2 because out of his sheer desperation, looking for comfort among his fellow human beings, he is now forced at the end of verse 2 to look upward, and that is a link to verse 3. So verse 3 is not an address to his friends. It is an address directly to God. It is to God that he is saying, lay down now, put me in a surety with thee. What the lay down now means, again, derives from the ancient legal practice, so it is not entirely clear what that phrase means. However, the next phrase, put me in a surety with thee, can be understood in the following way. Job is appealing that his case go for arbitration. Do not forget that he has been maintaining all along, not that he is sinless, but that his present afflictions are entirely unmerited, that they are over and above whatever sins he might have committed, that he has consistently dealt with sin in his life in the God-honoring way through a blood sacrifice, through confession and prayer. Therefore, whatever he is enduring or suffering is out of all proportion to whatever charge may be leveled against him. So, since God has seen fit not to answer or respond to his claim for relief, Job has been bargaining all along that his case go for arbitration. He's well aware that since God is the complainant, the case has to go before God. And we considered this apparent paradox last week. God is the arbitrator who will decide the case, but God is also going to be the legal representative to speak up for Job. We went through this last week. I won't repeat what I said, but do bear this in mind. There is no contradiction here. The point is this. In any case of arbitration, the two parties involved must come to an understanding beforehand that whichever way the arbitrator decides, both of them will be bound by that decision. There will be no trying to subvert or to appeal against or to arm twist and get a verdict in favor of the person who lost. if that undertaking is not given by both parties, the mechanics of arbitration are wasted. It's a waste of time, because the party that loses out as a result of the verdict by the arbitrator is not going to honor the judgment, which means that the person who technically won the case gained nothing from the arbitration. Therefore, it is one of the prerequisites of arbitration that both parties give their solemn commitment to honor the verdict of the judge. So what Job is saying is, since the complainant who has brought these charges against Job is God himself, God is technically the petitioner and Job is a respondent, is going for arbitration before God. But now Job is arguing that since for the purposes of arbitration God is one of the parties involved, he is the petitioner and himself Job is the respondent, God must also agree to be bound by the decision of the arbitrator. That is the meaning of this expression, "Put me in a surety with thee." If you think about it, it's a very daring line of argument. It's almost, you can say, presumptuous. Frankly, I wouldn't dare to argue a case with God along these lines. I really wouldn't dare. And Job was not being careless about it. It must have taken a measure of faith that I cannot even begin to comprehend for him to be able to argue along these lines without coming under condemnation. That is a measure of the faith the man had, which is the level of faith which I certainly don't, and many of us really do not have. So bear in mind, Job is using legal terminology throughout this verse. The last part of this verse, "Who is he that will strike hands with me?" is an interesting expression, because the striking of hands refers to the usage of the open palm. I do not know if you have observed that young people today very frequently seem to greet each other by striking hands in this way. I do not know what it means. I do not know how it came about, but I observed it and it's quite amusing to watch. Little do they realize that in the ancient legal context, that striking of hands is an agreement that both parties will be bound by the oath or the undertaking that they have made. So the next time you strike hands with a friend of yours, bear in mind he's not just saying hello, but he's saying, "I will honor whatever commitment I made to you, and you must honor whatever commitment you made to me." This striking of hands was a well-known ancient practice of confirming an agreement. Example, Proverbs 22 verse 26, "Be not thou," this is a negative example, "be not thou one of them that strike hands, or of them that are sureties for debt." So this is a negative example, which raises a very interesting, if hypothetical, scenario which has been put up on the board. If a believer strikes hands with an unbeliever, meaning to say, comes to an understanding that a certain agreement will be enforced. So at the start, both have committed, both the unbeliever and the believer have committed to this agreement. Can the believer later on, should he find that things are not going the way he wanted, break that covenant with the unbeliever and justify it on the ground that because it was made to an unbeliever, he is not required to keep faith at all. He can break it at will. I believe that it was, I do not know if it still is, it was the teaching of the Roman Catholic Church that such covenants made with unbelievers, by believers, can be broken by the believer if circumstances so require it. And the justification for that is that since it was made with an unbeliever, the believer is not inextricably bound to honor it. If the circumstances require it for the greater good, whatever that is, the believer can break the covenant. Do you agree with that? It's a very compelling argument. Why not? After all, why should I as a believer lose out? I entered into this covenant in good faith. Now, these are the classic arguments we use, we have heard being used. I entered into this argument in good faith. And perhaps things were kept from me or I didn't know the whole story. And now I find I'm severely disadvantaged. After all, who is the other party to the covenant? It's an unbeliever. How do I know that he hasn't really tricked me? Therefore, I have to protect myself. I can break that covenant. And because it is not made with a fellow believer, I should not have any qualms about it. If you put it in that way, it's an extremely compelling argument. But before we say, yes, maybe, we are duty-bound to turn to the Word of God. And I would invite you to look at Ezekiel chapter 17 and verse 18. Before we read that verse, a little background. Nebuchadnezzar had taken away the last king of Judah, Jehoiakim, C-H-I-N, back to Babylon after Jehoiakim had ruled for only 3 months. And all his nobles were taken away with him to Babylon, where they were well treated, but they essentially would never see their homeland again. In the place of Jehoiakim, Nebuchadnezzar, realizing that the Jews would never accept a foreign ruler, selected the uncle of Jehoiakim, a man named Zedekiah, whom he named Zedekiah, to rule as the king, reasoning that the Jews would better accept one of their own kind. So Nebuchadnezzar's covenant with Zedekiah was that so long as Zedekiah did not try to undermine the Babylonian king, did his duty by paying taxes and by keeping the peace with Babylon, he could do pretty much as he liked. However, as time went on, Zedekiah realized that this covenant was not really good for him because it deprived him of the prestige and the power that he had enjoyed or that Judah had enjoyed. And he was itching to get out of it. So what he did was he applied this reasoning that, look, after all, it is made with not only an unbeliever, a person who worships pagan gods. Such a person must be contemptible in the eyes of Jehovah. Why therefore am I so bound to an unbeliever, to a worshipper of pagan gods? I shouldn't be. I am a child of the living God. I shouldn't be bound by this kind of constraint. So with these arguments behind him, he went secretly to the king of Egypt to strike an agreement for military support. And when Zedekiah found out about it, when Nebuchadnezzar found out about it, the consequences on Zedekiah were pretty severe, as you can imagine. And here is the comment of God relayed through Ezekiel in chapter 17, verse 18. Seeing he, Zedekiah that is, installed as puppet king of Judah by Nebuchadnezzar, despised the oath by breaking the covenant he had made with the Babylonian monarch, when lo, he had given his hand, he had struck hands because he has broken that covenant, even though it be with an unbeliever, what does God say in judgment? He, Zedekiah, shall not escape. There is a very important principle from this scenario, and the principle is this, that we are told not to incur debts. Good principle. And there is one debt that is owing to all human beings. That debt is not money. That debt is something called truth. What it means is that each one of us has to be truthful to the other, irrespective of whether that other party is a believer or unbeliever. Truth is a debt that is owing to all men, believer and unbeliever alike. Consider if under these circumstances a believer were to break his covenant with an unbeliever and try to justify it on the grounds that after all it was made with an unbeliever, would that not give plenty of occasion for the unbeliever to blaspheme against the one living and true God? Therefore, it's not just because the covenant has been broken, but because it casts a black mark upon the God behind the covenant. God says he will judge the covenant breaker, even if it be a believer, he will judge the covenant breaker without mercy. Therefore, can a believer in the right circumstances break a covenant he has struck with an unbeliever? Emphatically, no. Verse 4. For thou hast hid their heart from understanding, therefore shalt thou not exalt them. If you think carefully about it, this is actually a very remarkable line of argument. What is driving this argument is actually contained in the answer to the first question of the Westminster Shorter Catechism. Most of us know or should know the first question and answer of the Shorter Catechism, which is that man's chief end is to glorify God and to enjoy Him forever. What comes first? Is enjoying Him forever? No, that comes later. What comes first is the glory of God. It is this which is driving the argument of Job in verse 4 of chapter 17. Look at the last part of that verse. Therefore shalt thou not exalt them. Thou hast hid their heart from understanding. It is the glory of God that is driving this argument. What Job is saying is that his friends have proved themselves to be incapable of acting as sureties for him in any trial before God. The reason that they are effectively disqualified from acting as character references, if you like, for Job, is because they have been judicially blinded by God. Judicially blinded by God so that they perceive Job in his present condition as nothing more than a man under judgment, which is not true. That being the case, and here is the first conclusion, which follows logically, you can't fault Job's logic. Therefore, God must himself bear the responsibility, both for sending these undeserved afflictions upon me, and for the fact that my friends, my closest friends, are blinded from seeing the truth. The responsibility can only rest with God. And therefore, yet again, if God does not hear my petition and vindicate me, the loser, so to speak, in the final analysis, the loser is going to be not me, but God. Because God is not going to get the glory due to His name. Do you see the kind of daring that there is in this line of argument? It is stupendous, and really it takes an enormous amount of faith for a person to be able to argue in this way with God. As far as I can tell, there is only one other instance in the whole Bible of someone in like faith arguing in so daring a fashion and getting away with it. Can you guess who that person was and where the incident is to be found? It is to be found in the New Testament, and curiously enough, it involves a Gentile. Job was a Gentile with such faith in God that he could argue along lines which most of us wouldn't dare to follow. Not that he was demeaning God, but because he had rock solid confidence that God would hear and judge aright. And that's what led him to tread a very fine line. The second instance, the second person who used that kind of daring in argument successfully was also a Gentile. And it happened to be a woman, a Syrophoenician by birth. And they have given away the clue. You can find it in Matthew chapter 15, reading from verses 21 to 28. Then Jesus went thence and departed into the coast, into the territory of Tyre and Sidon, coastal cities, as you remember. Verse 22, and behold, a woman of Canaan, a Syrophoenician by birth, according to Mark chapter 7, verse 26. The woman of Canaan came out of the same coast territory and cried unto him, that is, cried repeatedly, unceasingly, saying, have mercy on me, O Lord, thou son of David. My daughter is grievously vexed with the devil. But he, Jesus, answered her not a word. And obviously the woman kept pestering Jesus. And his disciples came and begged Jesus, saying, send her away, for she crieth after us. But he, Jesus, answered his disciples and said, I am not sent but unto the lost sheep of the house of Israel. And then obviously the disciples stopped blocking the woman, so she was able to come and fall at the feet of Jesus, and kneeling, which is the implication in the word, worshipped. Then came she and worshipped him, basically kneeling at his feet, saying, Lord, help me. Now follow this argument. Jesus tries to blunt her request with a very, what to us would be a very sharp thrust. He answered and said, it is not meet to take the children's bread and to cast it to dogs. I am pretty sure that if any one of us were at the receiving end of that rebuff, we wouldn't have the heart to carry on. But this woman took it in her stride, and see what she said. Verse 27, and she said, truth, Lord, she did not contest it. To contest it would have been a capital mistake. Firstly, because it was true. And secondly, she recognized Jesus as the Son of David. Therefore, whatever he said, it would be futile to contest it. So she did not contest it. And there was again her faith. Truth, Lord, yet the dogs eat of the crumbs which fall from their master's table. Then Jesus answered and said unto her, O woman, great is thy faith. Be it unto thee even as thou wilt. And her daughter was made whole from that very hour. These are the only two examples I can find of believers, and coincidentally both Gentiles, to adopt so daring a line of argument and passing the test with God. Finally, for today, verse 5, he that speaketh flattery to his friends, even the eyes of his children shall fail. just reading that verse alone tells us that it is some kind of proverb that Job is citing. But what does it mean? Again, go to the words, and really the only word that we need to focus on is flattery, which comes, is a rendition of the Hebrew kalek, which literally means smoothness of texture. However, in certain contexts, kalek can also be a lot or a portion that is divided out according to some rule or method. So what is Job referring to when he speaks of he that speaketh flattery to his friends? Job is warning his friends through the citing of this proverb that a man who betrays the residence of a neighbor or friend to a robber becomes thereby an accessory after the fact and will be severely punished by God. And how will God severely punish such an offender? Even the eyes of his children shall fail. To appreciate the severity of this punishment, you look at Proverbs chapter 30, verse 17. The eye that mocketh at his father and despiseth to obey his mother, the ravens of the valley, the scavenger birds, shall pick it out, and the young eagles shall eat it. So really, the severity of the punishment is the point to be aware of. That even the children of a person who bears false witness against an innocent party will be so punished. This is a point that is again mentioned in Deuteronomy chapter 19, verse 16, where the punishment for a talebearer is clearly specified. The final verse for today is not verse 5, it's verse 6. It's a rather difficult verse, so bear with me. I will zip through it at light speed, and hopefully I will leave you still standing. Verse 6, He hath made me also a byword of the people, and aforetime I was as a tabret. The difficulty is the word tabret in the Authorized Version refers to a small drum or other musical instrument that is beaten upon. How does that fit into this context? We shall try and explain. First of all, He hath made me also a byword of the people. Byword, the Hebrew mashal, literally means to be like, but the comparison intended is in a derogatory sense. As for example, in Psalm 28 verse 1, David says, Unto thee will I cry, O Lord, my rock, be not silent to me, lest if thou be silent to me, I become like them, mashal, that go down into the pit. So there is an implied comparison, but the comparison is in a derogatory sense. The complaint of having become, complained by Job that he has become an object of scorn or contempt, which is carried over in the first half of this verse, is reinforced by the second half of the verse. And aforetime, before all this, I was as a tabret. We already mentioned that tabret refers to a small drum. But go back to the Hebrew, and the word rendered tabret is tophet, which literally means an act of spitting to show contempt. Similar usage is to be found in Numbers 12 verse 14 in relation to Miriam, who had tried to oppose Moses. And you recall that she was punished by God with leprosy. Numbers 12, 14, The Lord said unto Moses, referring to Miriam, the elder sister, If her father had but spit in her face, should she not be ashamed 7 days? So Tofes refers to an act of spitting in order to show contempt. So how does that fit in with this verse 6? He has made me also a byword of the people, aforetime I was as a tabret. It is difficult without access to the notes of the King James translators. It is impossible to say why they chose the word tabret. But we can be sure that given their level of scholarship and devotion to the Lord, they must have had a pretty good reason. The general sense is clear though. Basically, Job is protesting that he has become an object of scorn by the society around him. And in verse 7, he says, in addition to all of that, I can't see clearly because I'm weeping all the time. And all my members are as a shadow. Basically, I have been reduced to skin and bones. Verses 8 to 10 are going to be particularly difficult. So I think it is best if we leave that for the next lesson. So God willing, we shall meet again to consider verses 8 through 10 and hopefully the rest of chapter 17.